content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. Hello, this is Shadate Hargett-Hill from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Sports Illustrated for Kids. Today's programming is underwritten with support from the Raleigh Kiwanis Foundation. They can be reached at www.kiwanisfoundation.org. Last week, we left off with a trivia challenge. The question was, Atlanta Braves 20-year-old left fielder Ronald Acuna Jr. homered in 5 consecutive games in August. At 20 years, 239 days old, he became the youngest since at least 1908 to do so. Who is now the second youngest player? A. Brian McCain, 2006, Mike Trout, 2012, or Cody Bellinger, 2017. Ready for the answer? The answer is Brian McCain, who was 22 years, 150 days old when he did it for the Braves that July. And we'll have more in-zone questions for you a little later in the show. Let's take a look at golf. A look back at 2018 on the links. From fantastic firsts to spectacular seconds to compelling comebacks, this season has included its share of drama. Here are three stories that dominated the headline. Francesco Molinari on a roll. He won his first PGA Tour event, the Quicken Loans National, on July 1st. 3 weeks later, the 35-year-old won the British Open by 2 strokes, becoming the first player from Italy to ever claim a men's major golf championship. Unthinkable, Molinari said of playing the final 2 rounds of the Open with a single bogey. Arya Juntunen wins second major. The 2016 Rolex Player of the Year and LPGA Tour money leader won her second major, the U.S. Women's Open in June. Through the end of August, the 22-year-old had 3 victories this season and was second in the Women's World of Golf rankings. Juntunen, who is from Thailand, also led the 18th official money list by nearly $1 million. And, of course, Tiger Woods is finally back. He missed the 2016 season and underwent the 4th back surgery in April 2017. Woods then played just his 3rd PGA Tour event 28 months later, last December, tying up 9th. Since then, the 14th time major champion has finished in the top 10 5 times, including tying for 6th at the British Open and coming in 2nd at the PGA Championship. And we move on to swimming. Lee Hayes is the 2018 Sports Kid of the Year. Lee Hayes wins a lot. 13-year-old swimmer almost never loses when she races near her hometown of Sugar Grove, Illinois, a suburb of Chicago. She owns 6 national age group records, 2 of which she set this year, and some longer local events. She laps her opponents. Winning fuels her. Who doesn't love winning, she says. But as much as she loves winning, she hates seeing other people down. After a victory, Lee will often swim over to a competitor who was taking the loss hard and console her. Officials tell her coach how impressive Leah's sportsmanship is, and she wants to make others better. Her relay times are sometimes faster than her individual ones. There was a period, however, when Leah wasn't so confident. When she was 6, she began to suffer from alopecia, a disease that causes hair loss. After struggling with its effect, she now embraces her look and uses her success in the pool to spread a message. Don't let anybody hold you back. Be confident in everything you do. Her ability to win races makes her a great swimmer. Her ability to do it with grace and positivity makes her the 2018 Sports Kid of the Year. Fast off the blocks. Though Leah's mom, Jill, was a collegiate swimmer at Western Illinois, she and her husband, Tim, didn't expect to have a swim family. Leah's older brother, Carter, participated in a number of different sports, and their parents thought that Leah would do the same, but that changed when she got in the pool. Nancy Hooper, a coach and former national record holder herself, first saw Leah when she was 8. "I was like, wow," says Hooper, who has coached Leah ever since. "She just had the natural ability to swim." Leah's progress in the pool was rapid. She won her first state title at age 9 in the 50-meter breaststroke. "She flew," says Hooper. Everyone was wondering, who is she? The swimmer who nobody knew became addicted to the thrill of winning. "It's the best feeling ever," Leah says. "Every time I win, I feel like I won the Olympics." Leah, who was diagnosed with alopecia when she was 6, owns her differences and tries to set an example for others. As a 10-year-old, Leah went on a 2-week winning spree that etched her name into the record book. To hear Leah tell it, she had no idea what was happening. "I was just out there swimming," she says. In fact, she was 5 national age group NAG records over 2 meets. The names of Olympic stars such as Missy Franklin, Katie Ledecky, and Simon Manuel appear over and over in that record book. Leah is in there 6 times. The first record fell at the Illinois Long Course Age Group Championship. Leah broke the 200-meter freestyle NAG for ages 10 and under by more than a second, 2:14.87. A day later, she took the 50 free record, 28:33. The next week at the Central Magazine 14 and under championship in Indianapolis, she set marks in the 100-meter freestyle, 50-meter breaststroke, and 200-meter individual medial. The latter record has stood for 13 years. The swimmer who set it, Elizabeth Beisel, now has 2 Olympic medals and was a co-captain of the 2016 team. "Having my name down in history, I can't really explain the feeling," Leah says. "It's just great." Leah doesn't just dominate swimmers her own age. In August at a USA Swimming Futures Championship, Leah competed in a field that included 20 and 21-year-old collegiate swimmers. She won the 200-meter IM, coming in just 0.4 of a second from breaking Franklin's age group record. Because it includes all 4 strokes, the IM is a test of a swimmer's all-around skill, which Leah has in abundance. "She swims with absolute fire and passion," Hooper says. "I feel very confident that she will be at the Olympic trials in 2020. Leah's success in the pool has appeared to come quite easily, but on her journey to becoming a swimming superstar, she encountered some choppy waters. Leah tackled all 4 strokes in the individual medley and tests of swimmers' all-around skill. When Leah was 6, her mom noticed a spot on her missing hair on her head. Doctors successfully treated it as alopecia, characterized by the loss of patches of hair. But by the following spring, her hair started falling out again. This time, treatment didn't work. A few months into the following school year, she had lost all her hair, including her eyebrows and eyelashes. Leah was diagnosed with alopecia universalis, a rare form of the disease. At first, before she lost all her hair, she wore a toupee to school to cover the top of her head. She then changed to a wig, which she wore for about 3 years, but she never wore it around the pool. That was her freedom, Tim says. Occasionally, the wig would fall off, and other kids would notice. Rumors began to spread. "What's wrong with Leah?" By the time she reached 4th grade, Leah was, as she says, done with it all. One day she came home and announced, "I'm going to school tomorrow and I'm going to tell everyone." "Beforehand, we had a conversation," says her 4th grade teacher, Shani Bakani. "I said, are you ready for how kids might take this?" And she said, "I'm tired of hiding who I actually am." Leah had planned what she was going to say, but she was still nervous. In the school's cafeteria, in front of 100 fourth graders, she explained why she didn't have hair anymore. Afterward, Leah went to the bathroom. Then she took off her wig, looked into the mirror, and began to cry. I was just so happy, she recalls. When she joined us in the classroom, the kids hugged her and were so excited for her, Picani says. The support was amazing. She was already mature and so confident. Mature, once she took that wig off, it came out even more. That took a lot of guts, Tim says. In middle school now, she's completely cap-free. She rocks it. Leah loves being around her Fox Valley Park District Riptide teammates. If Leah somehow doesn't win a heat, look out. That's not going to be where she finishes the final, Hooper says. It's the look on her face. But she wants to compete with respect. She makes sure to congratulate each swimmer after a race. She doesn't pump her fist. Even when she breaks a record, she'll give trophies or ribbons to friends and fellow competitors. We've preached sportsmanship, but she's always had a kind heart. Tim says, Leah loves to hang out with her friends and to binge watch Netflix. She's currently on her second season of viewing The Office. She is a devoted patron of Chipotle. Her order, brown rice, pinto beans, carnitas, sour cream, cheese, and guacamole. She has one big goal that's next on her list, the 2020 Olympics in Tokyo. Leah will turn 15 2 months after the game. It's not uncommon for the 15-year-old to swim at that level. Michael Phelps finished fifth in the 200-meter butterfly in 2000, and Ledecky won gold in the 800 free in 2012. Whether Leah qualifies for Tokyo remains to be seen, but one thing is clear, at every step of her journey, win or lose, she'll be fast. She'll be sportsmanlike, and she'll be herself. And now let's catch up with the 2017 Sports Kid of the Year, Bunchy Young. Since being named the 2017 Sports Illustrated Kids Sports Kid of the Year 12 months ago, life has become even more of a blur for Maxwell Bunchy Young. To receive his award, Bunchy and his family traveled to Brooklyn, where they took part in a televised ceremony that included some seriously big names who were being honored as part of Sports Illustrated's Spokesperson of the Year ceremony. Bunchy got to meet several of them on the red carpet. Recalls Bunchy, J.J. Watt told me, keep grinding, keep working. He sent me some of his shoes, too. And Joel Embiid, we had like an hour conversation about NBA and working hard. He also got to go up on stage during the ceremony to be interviewed by television star Joel McHale. Bunchy was named Sports Kid of the Year because of his positive attitude, his caring spirit, and his ability on the football field and on the track. He racked up touchdown after touchdown for his football team. The 11-year-old was so impressive that he was actually offered a scholarship by the University of Illinois. He's still competing and still dominating. I've moved from safety to cornerback this year, he says. On offense, he's still a do-it-all three threat with all the ball in his hand. I scored 13 or 14 touchdowns, he says. Bunchy has also been busy off the field. He helped launch a line of youth outwear for kids for Under Armour. I have my own jacket line. I got to work with other kids across the country. We did photo shoots, he says. It was really, really fun. One of those photos ended up on a billboard in New York City. Bunchy has always been serving as a sports ambassador for the 2028 Olympics, which will be held in Los Angeles, which is near Bunchy's home. I know the mayor. We're working on a campaign for the Olympics, and I get to hold the torch, so that's pretty cool. It's a perfect project for Bunchy because it combines two of the things he aspires to achieve. Asked what he wants to do when he gets older, the 11-year-old says, I want to be mayor. I want to go to the Olympics, and I want to make it to the NFL. Don't bet against him. It's been a whirlwind year for Bunchy, and things aren't showing any signs of slowing down. On now to hockey. Ranger center Mika Zibanejad loves New York on and off the ice. When he's not on the ice helping the New York Rangers center, Mika likes to keep busy. Coming off the team's fifth straight home win, the Rangers were given a day off on a Sunday. Mika decided to spend it shoe shopping, and he invited the Psy Kids reporter to tag along. At the sneaker store, Mika struggled to choose, but ultimately decided on a design featuring the New York City skyline, a tribute to the place he calls home these days. "I love living and playing in New York," he says. "I'm so lucky to play here. I have great teammates and great coaches. I love everything about this city." The 25-year-old former first-round pick has enjoyed playing in New York so much that he can now look back and laugh at the unfortunate timing of his trade from the Ottawa Senators in 2016. "When I was on the Senators, I spent all my days off meeting with architects because I was building a house," he says. "I put a lot of time into it. Finally, when it was all done, I was really excited, and I just couldn't wait to live in the house after all the work that went into it. But a week later, I got traded." With the benefit of perceptive, the Swedish-born pivot came to a solution. "It taught me what to do next, and that is to just build a dream home in Sweden. When you think about it, I'm not going to be traded from Sweden." Mika says he enjoys getting involved in projects. For him, it's a way for him to focus his energies on things that he is passionate about. "One of his biggest passions is music. I enjoy composing," he says. "I've already written and produced 3 songs." When he's not writing music, shopping for shoes, or designing his dream home, Mika enjoys watching soccer. He dyes streaks of his dark hair blonde in honor of Lionel Messi, one of his favorite players. He also keeps up with the latest news about his beloved Manchester United. And when he has the time, he will indulge in his love for gaming by playing FIFA. "I play FIFA and Fortnite," he says, "but I'm slowly getting worse at Fortnite." On the ice, however, Mika seems to be quickly getting better. Through 21 games, he has 7 goals and 10 assists. The 0.81 points per game pace so far would be the best of his career. He credits first-year head coach David Quinn for his ability to communicate to the players. "He has a system that everyone buys into, and the team is doing very well." He also credits his good start to a strong work ethic and commitment to staying fit and healthy. When the season is done, he says he will be happy to have a nice home to go back to in Sweden, but he hopes it won't be until sometime in the end of June. And next in racing, interesting story about driver Brett Wiscott, who won a race in a borrowed car. Brett Wiscott was ready to race in the National Auto Sports Association Championship in Austin, Texas, but there was one problem. His car wouldn't start. Luckily for the 34-year-old Wiscott, who was competing in the Performance Touring D category, a friend who was racing in another category, Chris Kotowski, had brought a second car to the competition and said he would loan it to Wiscott. Thanks to the loaner car, Wiscott not only got to race, but he was the first to cross the finish line. "It was nice to finally get out the top step," said Wiscott, who had earned 2 second places and a 3rd place in 4 previous trips to the national championships. Hoping to get an extra edge on the competition, Wiscott had built a new engine for his Nissan NX2000 before the race. He then brought his car from his hometown of Omaha, Nebraska, to Austin. The championship took place over 4 days in September and attracted 467 amateur and professional drivers in 31 categories. He was testing out his car on the track before the competition when the oil light came on and the engine broke down. Wiscott, who works at an auto body shop, went to work to try to fix the car, but time was running out and the car still wasn't drivable. Kapowski, who is from Sioux Falls, South Dakota, loaned Wiscott the second car and Mazda Miata, and Wiscott made the most of the race. Since his big win, Wiscott has put the original engine back in his Nissan. He has won 3 races with the old engine in the car. "It's working now," he said with a laugh. Racing has always been a part of Westcott's life. He grew up watching his dad, John, in stock car and drag races. John is also an auto mechanic, so Brett watched his dad build engines and fix the cars himself. Watching his dad scrape together the parts he needed to race inspired Westcott to work hard and not worry if he couldn't afford the best car parts. His passion for racing and his ability to figure things out when he didn't have all the best stuff is what rubbed off. Westcott said he learned from his dad how to overcome the toughest part of becoming a race car driver. The hardest part is probably the stuff that happens when you aren't racing, Westcott said. Finding the time and the money and getting everything set up right is the hardest part. It wasn't until he was 24 that Westcott decided to try racing for himself. He said he wasn't very good at first, but he didn't give up and kept practicing on local racetracks in Nebraska and Iowa. He also uses a simulator on his computer at home to get a feel for what it's like to race at different tracks. Last year, he got into his first accident during a race in Topeka, Kansas. Westcott crashed his car, which was a Nissan Sentra, into a wall going about 100 miles per hour. The accident occurred so fast that he didn't know what happened until afterwards. I was driving and then suddenly I wasn't, he said. There wasn't time to be scared. His vehicle was in bad shape, but thanks to safety gear, Westcott was unharmed. His plan to continue racing and knows what would he say if NASCAR called. If they gave me an offer, I'd certainly say yes, Westcott said. I would certainly like that opportunity. Until then, he will continue to race whenever he can. He hopes his story encourages kids to follow their dreams. The key to succeeding is to ask for help when you need it, Westcott said. Find someone who is positive, who will want to help you, he said. There's always someone out there who wants to give a new person a hand. When another story from one of the kid reporters talking about his day covering the 2018 New York City Marathon. It was a Sunday, and it was the 48th running of the New York City Marathon, a 26.2-mile race that runs through each of the five New York boroughs. Athletes from all over the world fly to Big Apple to participate in this great tradition. In 2018, the race had more than 50,000 participants representing more than 130 countries. I was at the starting line before the marathon began, in the lead vehicle for the men's wheelchair race, and at the finish line when the first athlete, Daniel Romachuk, arrived. Romachuk, who also won the Chicago Marathon last month in October, became the first American in history to win the NYC Marathon's men's wheelchair race, and he did it by 0.01 of a second. It's an amazing experience to be able to win two major marathons in a row, he said. Afterward, it still hasn't sunk in yet. Switzerland's Mayola Squire edged out five-time winner Tatiana McFadden of the U.S. in the women's wheelchair race. Mary Kintion of Kenya beat the field of elite women runners for the fourth time, and Lalisa Desisa of Ethiopia led the men. I am a native New Yorker, and one of the best parts of the day was traveling through all the different neighborhoods of the five boroughs. It definitely gives you a sense of diversity that makes New York so special. And along the way, at 8:30 in the morning in the cold, crowds were lined up cheering on the athletes. It made me proud to be a New Yorker. I tell you about my day. I woke up at 4 a.m. I got to the media staging around 5 a.m. My only description of the earliest hours was that it was still dark and cold outside in the low 40s. We were taken by bus from Times Square to Staten Island, which is the starting point of the race. I then went to the warm media tent, the local and foreign press, and spoke to them about their experiences covering the marathon. I also met with members of New York Road Runners, NYRR, who organized the event and who explained everything I needed to know about the race. After 45 minutes of waiting in the tent, it was race time. I was taken to the starting line where I watched the organizers get ready, as well as members of the New York Police Department, the New York Fire Department, the Armed Forces, and other first responders get ready for the opening ceremonies. I then climbed into the bed of the truck that served as the lead vehicle, and it was go time. The men's wheelchair race started at 8:30 a.m., and it was the perfect fall New York morning, although still cold in the open-air truck. My truck was the first to leave the starting gate. Two main purposes of the lead vehicle are to keep the unofficial time of the giant display that sits on the roof of the truck and to protect the athletes. We had to stay far enough away from them so that we weren't in their way, but also close enough so that no one crossed the street in front of them after we passed. Also, alongside the athletes were cyclists who used whistles and protected the athletes from pedestrians who dared to cross the street in front of the athletes and risk injury. I noticed those cyclists had their hands full. You'd be surprised how many people tried to cross the street as the athletes were approaching. The cyclists also had the job of alerting the people in the lead vehicle if they have approach spacing or if they are going too fast or too slow. This is key because the wheelchair athletes have an amazing speed, and the cyclist's job is to make sure no one gets too close to them. In terms of the competition itself, three men displayed their expert racing skills by pulling away from the rest of the pack almost immediately. Romacek, David Weir, and Marcel Hug. By mile three, these three were well ahead of the others and stayed that way throughout the duration of the race. Romacek was in the lead for the first 5 miles, keeping a steady pace throughout. However, towards the 9th and 10th miles, I started to see a technique that uses science to make the tough 26.2-mile race a little bit easier. Drafting. Drafting is when two or more competitors stay in a straight line to conserve energy and feed off each other's work, which means that the competitors in the back use the wind resistance from the person in front of the decrease the amount of friction in the air and therefore speed less energy. I also noticed that athletes did not pump or spin their wheels on the downhills because doing so might make the athletes lose control, particularly on the sharp turn coming off the Queensboro Bridge onto First Avenue. At the end, it was such an exciting race, and all three were within inches of each other and the finish line, with Romacek winning and making history. And that day of covering the 2018 New York City Marathon came for Sean Gandhi. And in the end zone, we have a question here. Butterfingers, the Pembroke Pirates are playing the Harrisburg Hotshots in a basketball game under NBA rules. Harrisburg point guard Alec King dribbles toward the three-point line and then stops. While looking for a teammate to pass to, he accidentally fumbles the ball. He has to take 2 steps to recover it, then immediately starts to dribble towards the hoop. The Pirates want a whistle. You're the referee. What's the call? Dun 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 dun. The call is play should stop on a whistle and the Pirates should get the ball. A player may not dribble a second time after a fumble unless the ball touches his team's backboard, basket ring, or another player. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Sports Illustrated for Kids. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Shadate Hargett Hill, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. Today's programming is underwritten with support from the Raleigh Kiwanis Foundation. They can be reached at www.kiwanisfoundation.org. If you have any questions, please call 919-832-5138. Again, the number is 919-832-5138. See you next time on the radio.